Thank you. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Robert. Thanks for asking me to do this tonight, Joe. Welcome to the newcomers. I know a little bit of sign language. Well, I know one sign, but they told me not to use profanity. But welcome. Can you guess what the sign is? In here, first thing a guy read to me, he says, "We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book." So if you're here for any other reason besides your problem with booze, you're in the wrong place, period. I said, "Hey, man, look, dude, I basically had like an organized level, you know, traffic meth across the country for like 18 years, you know?" And he goes, "Then you're in the wrong place. Can't help you with that." He says, "Man, I know this is all good and you want to help me out, but I got like 18 warrants, not just California, you know, Colorado, Hawaii, Nevada, Iowa." He's like, "Yeah, can't help you with any of that either. If you've got a problem with a wife and family, can't help you with that. If you're here for any other reason, Robert, than your problem with booze, you are in the wrong place, period. But if you've got a problem with booze, I can help you with that. Here in Alcoholics Anonymous, we're really good dealing with that problem." And he says, "It sounds like you got all kinds of problems and stuff going on." I was like, "Yeah, dude, I got a bunch." And he says, "Well, I'll tell you what, since you got all these problems going on, they've probably been there a while. Why don't you just not worry about them right now? Well, let's just deal with this. And at the end of it, if we go through this, you still got a problem with any of that stuff, I'll help you out to the best of my ability." So we got started. I grew up in the Midwest, a couple hours from Chicago, a place called the Quad Cities. And parents were good people, brothers and sisters. There wasn't an overly amount of violence in my house or anything, but any time there was or anything like that, it was very deserving. And if you know me at all, you'd say, "Oh yeah, I'd beat that kid too." Went to Catholic school and blah blah blah. I never really got into, I mean, I know all the like the Bible stories, like I know the Easter, the Christmas, and like the Good Samaritan like stories, you know. I never really got too much more into that. But I remember being a little kid, and for whatever reason, we always played basketball in the Midwest. I remember being outside when it was freezing cold, where your fingertips were all cracked. And every time the ball hit your fingers, they split open even more, you know, because you're so cold. I'd be out there with the driveway shoveled off, and some nights, like, it'd be clear and ice cold, like 10 degrees out, practicing. And I had these talks, like, with God, you know, I'd be looking up at the sky and stuff. And wasn't talking to the Jesus God, or Muhammad, or Jehovah, or, I don't know, Papa Bear. I wasn't, you know, I was just talking to this idea of God. Talking to him like I'm talking to you right now. And other than that, I don't remember my first drink. I know I probably sipped on my uncle's beer here and there. We probably snuck some booze from my parents' liquor drawer once in a while if I had an overnight friend. But I remember when I was in high school, I was about 16 or so, right about 16. We got our basketball team, we got like a couple cases of beer and that very elegant wine with the twist cap where you can see vapor trails afterwards. It's called Mad Dog 2020. So we drank that, you know, and I was pounding that stuff and having a good old time, you know, did the whole puking. And that night I found myself praying again to a porcelain god and begging him to make the room stop spinning. I'll never do this again. Next day, man, it was, you know, no big deal. It was just, everybody got drunk. It was fun. But I liked it. And a few weeks after that, real shortly after that, my brother had come home from college or something, and he was kind of like, oh, he got a free, he played basketball and stuff. He had the good-looking girls and all this. So, you know, naturally, being a younger brother, I kind of wanted to be like him. And parents were in bed, and he says to me, "Hey, you ever smoke weed?" "Well, yeah, sure, I smoke weed, yeah, you know, lying my ass off, wanting to look good." And so we smoked a little weed, drank some more beers. Next morning, I remember I called out what I consider like a burn, like someone like Culleton. I called somebody like Culleton and said, "Hey, man," I said, I need to get some marijuana." And they're like, "What, dude? You're a ball player. What are you talking about?" I was like, "No, dude, marijuana's cool. I want to get some marijuana." And all I knew about drugs was that I had seen on Miami Vice and shit. So my buddy says, you know, he's like, "Well, he wasn't my buddy. I didn't even, like I said, he was like Culleton. Who wants to hang out with that?" You know, the guy, I'd been working out here and there, like on the farm and stuff, making some money and had a couple little jobs. And I says, "Well, dude, I got like $500 right now I could spend." He's like, "I'll be there in 10 minutes. So we drove up to Iowa City, bought like a quarter pound for my first bag, got drunk the whole way. On the way back, you know, I got a whole like 101 on how to, you know, because I had to get the ball and the scale, the baggies. That's what I was told. So we did that whole thing. I got a 101 in drug dealing. And within two months, I'd been expelled from two schools, moved down to my parents' house, had my own apartment, which the police were properly kicking the door in at the moment. And I was like, "Son of a bitch, this is awesome. This is just great." Because, man, I don't know, man. There's something. I'm not one of the guys who gets, well, I get drunk and do illegal stuff and stupid stuff. I'm like a criminal. I enjoy stealing. I really, really enjoy it. I enjoy doing illegal activities. It's fun to me. It's exciting being chased by cops with warrants and stuff. It's just, I don't know why, but I just like it. And so they're all at this drinking, and the group of guys, my like crew, I guess you'd call them, that I hung around with, we had got into a, because of our, it's a lot like AA, I found out, because of my willingness, I excelled a little bit. And so, you know, the type of people I was like hanging around with, just to give you a little idea, okay? So I'm sitting in jail one night after like going to collect some money with a baseball bat. Ended up at the wrong house, poor guy. And so I'm sitting in this jail cell, and these detectives yank me out of this city jail to talk to me. And I'm like, "Man, usually I'd be in county by now. Why is this? How bad is it?" And they're like, "Here's the front page of the Quad City Times. They're my five best friends. They're involved in a police shooting the night before." And I remember thinking, as I'm getting in handcuffs, I'm letting them down. I'm supposed to meet those guys in like 20 minutes. So I was like, holy, you know. Then a couple other people I know had come to some really bad ends. But more than anything, there was this, you know, the girl, the one. And there was like my parents. And there was always this thing that happened. I'd like get in some really bad trouble. Then I'd like sober up just enough for like 3 days. And something would happen. There I go again, you know, all launched up, DUI, you know, some violent crime, whatever. And they'd look at me and say, "What happened, Robert? You were doing so well. Was it her? Was it the job?" And I was like, didn't have an answer. Didn't have an answer. But I knew this. That girl, no matter what she looked like or how much she loved or was willing to do, she could never do for me what booze did. Couldn't. My parents and all the good-meaning people that I met throughout my life who were like, "You got a problem. Hey, man, you can never do what booze did for me. Ever." Just couldn't, no matter how hard you tried. I drank, and booze just made everything all right. Didn't matter what the situation was. Didn't matter what my lot in life was at that given moment. I had a little liquor in me. Things were just all right. And so I took off from there because I couldn't stand the pain that I saw in their eyes anymore. And I was sick of that question. And I knew I was never going to have an answer for it. And I knew that booze was the problem. But, you know, I also knew I was never going to quit drinking. I just knew it. And so I took off. Went out to Colorado, and there's a strange thing if you're drunk like me. I always seem to know where to go find a job. It's you find the lowest, crappiest bar in town. This heads up if you plan on keep drinking. This is a good way to get a job. Find the lowest, like, working man class bar you can. And the guy who's the most angry, sitting by himself, get order a drink and sit down and just start complaining about something. He's wrong, she's wrong, this, son of a blah, blah, blah. What do you do for a living? Yeah, I need a job, blah, blah, blah. Next thing you know, you start buying him shots. You get him drunk enough, next day you got a job. So that's kind of how it happened. And this is an ongoing thing, man. I can maintain just drinking a little bit just to save up enough money to find the right person to invest again so I can make real money. Because I don't really want to work. What I really want to do is just get enough money to buy like a bunch of dope, and then I can just sit around and drink and sell dope. You know, I love just sitting at home drinking and drinking and drinking. Yeah, what do you want to do there? Okay, it's much easier. And so I got, you know, burned all the bridges there. Had to take off. Took off with a hippie. Driving across country because he knew where to get some stuff in a place called Humboldt. I said, all right, let's go. So we pull up in the Humboldt. He goes to get the stuff. And I walked down. I'd never seen the ocean. They had these big fishing boats and stuff going in and out. And some guy's screaming and hollering. He's complaining. He's like, I can't have a deckhand, that SOB, and blah, blah, blah. And he just happens to look over at me. He's like, you want to go out? Are you a deckhand? Oh, yes, sir, I am. So my buddy comes back. I got this like rain gear and a new fishing license a guy just bought me. And he's like, yeah, man, I got it. Let's go. And I'm like, no, just give me some because I'm going on this boat. Here's the keys. Here's the keys to my apartment and everything I own, man. This I'm going to do this for a little while. He's like, you really are out of your mind. So I started fishing, and fishing was great. Man, it's like, because you come to these different ports up in Crescent City, Coos Bay, and there's a great thing. The bar doesn't care if you have money. They really don't, because they know you're on this fishing boat. They know who your captain is. They know you're going to cash your check at the bar, because guys working on those fishing boats usually don't have IDs and bank accounts. So they knew I'd be coming back to cash my check. I just running tabs, you know? And so that was great. And it was something funny happened. Is when it was being my watch and stuff, where the boat was coming in, you know, like couple, it takes hours to get back to port. I'd be sitting in there, like sober now, because we've been out there a few days, a week, whatever. I had my feet up, I'd be looking at the radar, and it was my boat. In my head, it was my boat. You know, it was like, yeah, I own this. I'm the captain. I'm like the greatest fisherman ever. You're going to make movies about me and know me up and down the coast. Yeah. And then we come pulling in. And as soon as just about the time we got back to shore, this like thing would hit me. Dude, I'm never going to be nothing. I'm going to go to that bar and I'm going to get drunk. Just know it. Because what else, man? It's like, try to wait a week and be miserable. Try to make 2 days. I'm going to go get drunk. Park the boat. Walk over to that bar. Defeated, kind of. Just about time I'm opening that door, get a little bit of a smile. Get up to the bar stool. Get a drink. And God, this is a great life. I love this shit. This, right there, a couple of drinks. Somewhere magically between 3 and 4. Everything was all right again. I still hated you and didn't like you. But not as much. And so, you know, after doing all that and some things happened, you know, so I had to get out of town pretty quick again. And as my friend Rick always says, and this is one of the reasons I had to get out of town, if you want to get sober, if you're having trouble getting sober, this is a surefire way to do it. It works 100% of the time. Smack a cop in the mouth. Perfect. Every single time it works. Guaranteed. Usually for like 30 to 60 days. And so I get out of there and boom, I'm off, you know, I'm like, boom, I take some money, I go off to Hawaii. And let's just put it this way. We're not going to talk about Hawaii. Okay? All bad. Had to get out of there real quick, too. In like the middle of the night, got cash at the airport, you know, looking over my shoulder. I'm going to catch a bullet any minute. I mean, have you ever been fired from a drug dealing job because you're too drunk and can't remember where you left the stuff? More than once? I mean, it's like all you got to do is go from point A to point B. The problem was there was a liquor store like halfway between the two. And, man, I'm not lying. I really just don't know. I had it. And, yeah, they found no humor in it. None whatsoever. And, you know. So after being held by my ankles off of a building like 18 stories up, the only thing that saved my life is I work on high rises and stuff. Heights have never been a bother for me. So these guys who were hanging me over the building, the little, like, the 17th floor stuck out like a foot longer, and I knew this was my chance of like 6 hours of torture to get out. So I started kicking. Let me go. And I fell. Boom. And I hit the deck on the 17. These guys were so scared of heights looking over, they didn't know if they had dropped me or not, but I hear them, "We gotta go! We gotta go! We dropped him." So last night I took off. It was really interesting being on that plane. Just beat the hell, bleeding and stuff. The guy sitting next to me and says, "You look like you could use a drink." Really? How'd you guess? Maybe I just had it written on me. I don't know. So, get down here. I went to Vegas for a little while. I got to Vegas. I always have this ability to hook up with criminals. I just do. I'm a criminal. I'm attracted to that type. So after a few criminal activities, the state of Nevada Gaming Commission decided that I can never legally walk into any gambling establishment in the state of Nevada again. And the sheriffs made it quite clear that they wouldn't be dealing with my drunken criminal butt anymore, that the men who were in the suits across from the Greyhound ticket that they were handing me a bus ticket for anywhere in the U.S. just to leave Nevada, that those Nevada, like, casino guys in the suits, they would be dealing with me from now on. I've seen enough movies to know I should probably get on the Greyhound. So I end up in San Diego, drinking again. And at this point, it was just, you know what, I'm just drinking. That was it. No more excitement, no more nothing, just booze. I don't care about anything else. Leave me alone, man. So I posted up underneath the bridge down there on Imperial. Then I was on National for a while. And the only place I ever went was to Albertsons and Foodland to take half gallons. Lots and lots of half gallons I stole. I apologize if the prices went up on you at the end of your drinking. That may have been from me. Is anybody else ever disappointed when you take a bottle of water and you take a drink and you're waiting for it? It's like, oh, it's not Parpuff. every so often I do. I take a drink and I'm like, oh, what? That could have been. So I'm living underneath the bridge, you know, just stealing half gallons, hanging around with Father Joe's, doing nothing but drinking, waiting to die. And it wasn't my worst day. It wasn't anything spectacular. I come crawling out of this like little tent shacky thing I had going on after like 2 years, and I remember looking up at the sky and just pissed off. All right, God, whatever, man, you win, dude. I quit. I'm just done. So I walked down, seen a cop driving, and I'm shaking bad. I mean bad. And cop's driving down the road, and so I jump in front of the cop car. He hits his brakes. Gets out. What are you doing? I says, dude, I need help. Take me to jail, man. I need a nap, and I need some Librium. You know what I'm saying? And he's like, Virgo, I've arrested you a few times, like 7 or 8 already. I'm like, then you know where we're going, don't you, genius? Take me to jail. And I don't know what it was. Maybe it was just the way I said I need help or something. But he didn't take me to jail. Instead, this guy takes me to the hospital because I was shaking so bad. And I had a heart attack 2 years earlier because I went 16 hours without a drink. I got to the hospital. It was bad enough they wouldn't give me your liver enough. They gave me booze in the hospital for the first few hours to bring me down. And because the nurse was asking, the doctor's like, look, this dude's a drunk. He's going to die. We can't give him anything except booze and bring him down. So anyway, this cop takes me to the hospital. They gave me some Librium and stuff, and the doctors talked to him, and I'm like, think I'm sneaking out of the waiting room. And the cop says, hey, look, here's the deal, man. I know, you're taking me to jail now, aren't you? And he says, no, look, I'm going to try to get you into rehab or something, a detox. If I can't, I'll give you $10 and drop you off at Albertsons. You're in bad shape, dude. I says, all right. He put me up in a hotel that night downtown. Put the living room next to the phone and says, I will call you at 3 a.m. because that's the time you're supposed to take the next pill. And this is a cop I had smacked in the mouth. A cop I had been arrested by a few times. There was no love between me and cops, man. I never go politely. Ever. And calls at 3 o'clock in the morning, and somehow I had managed to stay sober from that hospital to there. I picked a pill up. I take it. He picks me up the next morning. He drives me to a detox. I get in there, and that first night or whatever, I'm sitting on the bed, and I think they had taken me to a meeting. I really don't recall. But I remember just thinking, these guys are talking about praying and this book and stuff, and they gave me a big book. No, they didn't give it. I stole it. And so I go into this bathroom, right? And something had flashed back to me. In like 2009 or something, I had needed to hide out from the law for a little bit, so I went to this like 90-day crash thing. I was like, yeah, dude, I'm on recovery. No, I just didn't want to get arrested that weekend. And there was this big tatted-up guy, three-striker, and he was telling us about how he used to pray in prison on his knees. I was like, you got on your knees in prison, dude, to pray? And he said, yeah, I wasn't praying to Jesus or anything else. When you get on your knees, you kind of got to pay attention to what you're saying, especially in prison. You get down, you make your point, and you get up. For whatever reason, that came back to me. And I went into the bathroom at that detox, and I shut the toilet lid, and I got down on my knees, and I'm like, wow, God, we've been here before, haven't we? Praying in front of a toilet again. How stupid do I look? And this is exactly to this day how I pray. Just like that little idea when I was a kid. I just talked to God like I'm talking to you, man. Because I'm positive that if God, there is a God and he knows me, he knows I don't talk like thee, thou, this, and Holy Mary, Mother of God, our Father. None of that. So I was just like, look, man, I don't want to drink anymore, period. I'll do whatever these people are asking. I don't care. I just don't want to drink. So after like 2 weeks in there, I get out and the cop picks me up, gets me into a homeless shelter down the hill there by Father Joseph's. It was a tent, a winter tent or something. And then they drop me off at this meeting, a 1 o'clock meeting up there on 30th Street. Now, as I'm walking out of this meeting, I don't recall what was said, or Joey is probably leading, you know, is the mayor. So as I'm walking out, this guy walks up to me. And he says, hey, man, did you choose not to drink today? And I says, yeah, so far I have. And he got up in my face. And he's like, yeah, so why don't you stop wasting our fucking time and go choose not to drink the rest of your life? Sorry about the language, but that's exactly what he said. And certain times, when I'm drunk or certain times I relate to that drunk, that language. And in a heartbeat, just like that, for the first time in my life, I related to a sober alcoholic. Through all the good-meaning people in my life who tried to help me and everything else, oh, we'll love you too, you love yourself. No, oh, you can do it, man. We'll be there with you. You know, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. You know, well, here's all those little sayings. If any of that's true, then everything in this book is a lie. If any of that's true, everything in this book is a lie. Period. The guy asked me, and I said, yeah, what are you talking about, dude? You know, like, I'm a little ticked, dude. I'm like, don't waste my time. But instantly, I could relate to the guy. He knew every lie I was going to tell. He knew the anger inside. He knew I wanted to deck him. But I also looked at him, and I knew this guy wasn't going to, he was serious. You know, like when you're about to get in a fight and you know all the talking's done and it's time to go. That's the feeling I had, and I knew that feeling. Then he says to me, he read that, we have Alcoholics Anonymous, among 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show others precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. He says, so let me ask you, do you know what hopeless means? Yeah, dude. It's less than hope. It's right in the word. So, he didn't giggle so much. So he says, you know what? I said, man, yeah, you know, my life's ruined, but whatever I said. He goes, you know what? Do me a favor. If you don't know what the word means, don't lie to me. And don't try to make it up. He says, you know what? Why don't you do, what are you going to stay in? I said, I'm this homeless shelter. He goes, well, then you got nothing better to do. Go find a dictionary and find out what the word means. And while you're at it, the first step says powerless. Find out what those two words mean. Well, magically, somehow that afternoon, I think I need to go check an email because I was so important being homeless and no one talked to me in 30 years. I should go check that email. So there's this huge dictionary over at the library and I found myself looking at it. I walked over and I looked up the word hopeless and I got a pen and paper. The pen to stab him with after I told him and the paper to write it down. True story. I was, yeah. So it says hopeless. As in fatal illness, no chance of medical recovery. That's not what I was expecting to read. As in fatal illness, no chance of medical recovery. Powerless, unable to achieve an effect. What was the effect I wanted? I wanted to be sober. I can never keep myself sober. Not with this going, telling me I'm not going to drink today, I am going to drink today. And the more I try not to drink with that thing going on, the quicker I drink. So I went back the next day and I had my definitions written down. He's walking up. Hey, man, I got those definitions. You want to know what they mean? And he says, no, I know what they mean. And he goes into the meeting. Really? So he comes out and he says, let's go sit over here. We went and sat down. And he explained to me, we of Alcoholics Anonymous, more than 100 men and women who have recovered from seemingly hopeless, that every single one of those 100 men and women at some point had sat at a table across from my doctor. And that doctor looked at them and said, look, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. You should get your affairs in order. There's absolutely nothing we can do for you. You're going to die. Now, I've been thousands of times in hospitals because of my drinking. Whether I woke up handcuffed to something, or whether somebody found me drunk, passed out, whatever. And that paperwork always said acute alcoholic. Acute alcoholism. And they always booted me right on the street real quick. Because those doctors couldn't help me and they knew it. Stitch him up, give him some Librium, kick him out. Because they knew it. They can't help you. They just can't. So, that was me, man. Hopeless. And I'm not talking, I couldn't find a job or this and that or any of that. I was going to die and I knew it. You don't shake and have heart attacks and stuff when you don't have booze. And end up well. So, this guy says, be here tomorrow. I walked up there and met him the next day. And we started reading this book and started reading the doctor's opinion. In the doctor's opinion, and we talked about drinking. Talked about, you know, when you're just going to that bar, Robert, you know, this thing's going like bat out of hell. It just won't stop. You know, it's her, it's him, it's a job, it's my lot in life, I'm never going to get ahead, and all this stuff, and it's just going a million miles an hour. You don't want to drink, I'm not going to drink, I am going to drink. And you said, oh, and you just get a couple pulls, you know, just to make it stop. Funny, I never once had a, never once did it occur, come across my mind that, gee whiz, I sure hope this works this time. Oh, please let it work. Booze worked for me the first time I drank it. It worked for the last time I drank it. The effect produced by alcohol. You know that breath? I just feel a little bit better. That's what I wanted. That's all I wanted. But I'm just going to have one more. Then here you go. Drunk again, going to jail again, or waking up the next day needing that drink again. You know you're bad when your buddy's got to hold your head so you don't chip your teeth. And explained real well in there that my body may be different from a normal person when it comes to booze. See, I thought I could always just outdrink everybody. You're weak. Oh, I'm Irish-Italian. I can drink more, blah, blah, blah. Well, it kind of answered all of the questions. That maybe something is different about me physically. I know I'm taller, better looking than most people, so I can kind of grasp that my body is different. So that I put... And the idea that I put booze into my body and something happens where my body demands more. They don't have a name, they call it physical phenomenon of craving. And I said, you're an idiot. I know you're a plumber, but you're not well educated and that can't make any sense whatsoever. no, my body can't do that. He says, really, your body can't outride your mind? And he put it into terms I could understand. He says, how about this, Robert? We get on a boat, go out to a nice lake, and I throw you out of that boat, and I put my hand on top of your head while you're underneath water. What starts to happen? I start to panic, man. I got to breathe. Right. And then eventually, after a minute and a half, wait, you smoke. After about 45 seconds, what starts to happen? I said, man, what? You're under. You breathe, dude. You drown. He goes, so you chose to breathe? Wait, what? What? Well, did you choose to breathe? Knowing you were going to take in that water and drown and die? Did you choose to breathe if you're under that water? Nah. My body just needed the air. And I did something. It misfired. All that information of what was going to happen if I breathed. My body just needed it. And took a breath. And you drowned. I put booze into my body and something like that occurs. Despite knowing all the damage and everything else that's going to happen, that one isn't just going to do it for me. Once I put booze in my body, something happens between my body and the brain are amazing things. Something happens where I just keep drinking more and more. Drink till I throw up, then drink more. Drink till I black out, drink more. At least I think I drink more when I'm blacked out. I'm not positive about that. But I just drink. I just drank. And that answered all the answered things I could never answer for myself. And then somewhere, I told him that I had done that thing by hugging by the toilet. And he says, do it again. Tonight. Do it in the morning. And he was a big book guy. He said, that ain't in the big book. And he says, no, it's not. But how long have you been sober now? I was like, I don't know. That detox, and let's maybe 2 weeks or something. And he goes, so you've been sober. You've been doing that every day? Well, yeah. He says, then keep doing it. Doesn't matter if you're praying to God. Doesn't matter. I don't care if you believe in God. It kind of really doesn't matter at this point in time. Just do it. Take the action. This is a program of action. So I started doing that, talking to God just like I talked to you. Well, I use a lot more worse language. I think God can handle it. And so I started doing that. We started reading this book. And we talked about drinking. Talked about those mental twists that come before. Why is it? People always say, I hear it, I have a forgetter, man. I just didn't know how bad it was. That ain't me. I remember. I remember all of it. Problem is, at certain times, even before I take that drink, I know I'm going to jail. I know it. I'm not in a good mood, and I'm getting drunk, someone's getting punched. We're going to get one on tonight. And I know it. And I'm telling myself, don't do it. But this thing's going on, and I just jail it, and bad, I got to sleep. And what? I take a drink. I wake up in jail. Am I out of my mind? I knew this was going to happen again. At certain times, I just can't bring into my mind the suffering and the humiliation and all that stuff that it talks about in the book. It's not there. The given force isn't there to keep me from taking a drink. I'm powerless whether I'm going to take that drink or not. I drink every time. To this day, I've never once been able to keep myself sober. I didn't do it today. I get up in the morning, I say that little prayer. I do AA. Say a thank you at night. Now, when it gets to this part in here, about the third step, you know, made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. I hear people say all the time, well, I do 1, 2, and 3, and then I went and got drunk. No, you didn't. You cannot complete 3 without doing 5, 4, and 5. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives, our thoughts and our actions over to the care of God. You can't turn them over to the care of God until you do step 5. And if you're worried about sharing that stuff with another person, trust me, we don't care. I wish someone would have told me that, but literally we just don't care. And if you do it as outlined in the book, it's simple. It's very simple. It says moral inventory. The word moral means truth. It doesn't say immoral, amoral. I don't care what you did with that sheep and peanut butter. It does not matter. We're looking for the truth. Who you're angry at, why you're angry. Who you're angry at and why you're angry. And then where was I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? And for you to answer each one of those, where was I selfish? Where was I being dishonest? And it doesn't mean just dishonest, like I'm telling Andrew a lie. Where am I being dishonest with myself also? self-seeking and frightened. Usually I'm frightened because I wasn't going to get that thing that I was selfish for in the first place. Well, I was going to lose what I had. And we went through that. I told him one of my fears was that my mother would die before I was sober and could, you know, do well. And he said, "You're a freaking liar." He said, "You don't care if your mother dies. Everything we've talked about says you don't. Everybody worried their parents could die. You're worried about the shame and guilt you're going to have to live with her being a lousy son." Oh, is that what they're talking about? Even at that, poor mom's laying over here dead. And all I'm worried about is how I'm going to feel because she had the nerve to die before I've made her feel better. So when we did that, read that fifth step off. You know, made a list. Already had it. 9, came time to start making amends. And amends does not mean you are sorry. That's what he told me. Robert, amends does not mean you are sorry. It's to repair. You drive your car drunk through a fence. I'm sure you've done that, Robert. How do you make it right? I said, "Joe, I've never made that right." He said, "Well, if you were going to make it right," I said, "well, you go and mend the fence. Try to repair the stuff." I've never said sorry, not once, any of the amends I made. Wrote an amends letter to my mother, and sent a letter every week for close to 2 years before I heard anything. A week ago, I was in Chicago with my mother's at a home with 2 10-month-old boys, twins, identical, that me and my wife had. They had surgery, one of them, right 10 minutes after he was born. Surgery. It was real bad. They were born early and all this stuff. And you know what? I was there for them. I did what I was supposed to do. It was really mind-boggling because I was trying to work in Palomar, pay bills, and go to the hospital and all this stuff. And I hear people saying, "I did all that and didn't have to drink." Well, if you've taken the steps, I've taken the steps. The problem has been removed. It doesn't exist. So long as I continue to do this on a daily basis, that has been my experience. It's not a matter of, I didn't have to drink through it. It just simply is not a problem. It has been removed. And every problem that I've had in my life or situation, there are clear-cut directions in this book how to deal with every single one of them, if I'm willing to do AA. The second part of step one says our lives became unmanageable. I do not get that back. Ever. My mind's a little warped and a little twisted. I put stuff on paper. I read it to another human being. And I come up with a plan of action that'll work. But other men share their experience with me. They don't tell me what to do. This is what I did. Alcoholics Anonymous is the only thing that's ever worked for me. There are people who need Alcoholics Anonymous real bad, and it will not work for them. There are people who want Alcoholics Anonymous real bad, and it will not work for them. Alcoholics Anonymous only works for people who do it. We sat down, we took the steps. And we took him just as long as it took to get to that step, like 3 weeks. Then he told me, go find a drunk and start helping him, because that's what works when all else fails. People always say, if you're a newcomer, blah, blah, blah. I hate that. If you're a newcomer, this is what you do. Look, man. Tell you what. If you can't figure out how to stay sober one day at a time, come and talk to me. I'll show you what I did. There are men in this room, Colleton, Andrew, Sammy, Joe, Danny, Dave, Chris. There are men in this room who literally will show you what they did. You don't even have to beg or anything else. You don't even have to ask. You can just say, hey man, I'm having a problem with this booze stuff. That's it. And you can either take the steps. It says it clearly in this book. You can go on to the bitter end doing the best you can. Or you can take the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for letting me come tonight.